Hi, I'm Daniel. I'm an alcoholic.
Daniel.
From Boston, Massachusetts. If you ask anybody in Boston to describe me, the first words you'll hear is honest. And, you know, kind of doesn't make me a lot of friends because I don't have a lot of tact. And that's one of my defects, you know, I try to work on. Experience, strength, and hope. I don't like to talk about my experience a lot because I didn't get off the wrong bus stop and end up in an AA meeting. You know, I drank for 20 years. But the things I need to qualify my drinking, because the last time I didn't do it for a few years, and then when I did it last year, someone came up to me and said, "Thank you for sharing what you did, because I look at you and you have your life together and everything seems to be going good for you, and I never thought that you were actually that bad." I'm like, well, that's why I'm in AA, because things really were that bad, you know. You know, I'm an alcoholic, and, I fall down a lot, especially on my face, my chin. Fall down drunk is what I am, you know. My drinking career pretty much went for 20 years. And the last 5 years, about 95, is when I sat in my room in my apartment on a beautiful spring day, just came back from a liquor run with a 30-pack of beer and a bottle of Goldschlager, and I realized I couldn't, how was I going to go along with the rest of my life without drinking? It's almost like I came to a conclusion that I was an alcoholic and I didn't know what to do. So, you know, it was a slow and painful slide into my bottom. And my bottom came in 2001. I was a daily drinker. I wasn't a binger. I binged all my life, basically. It got to the point when my eyes opened up in the morning, the first thing I thought about was when my first drink was. Before my feet even hit the floor, I was wondering, click, when am I going to get a chance to drink today? And I worked in the restaurant business, and I was a waiter slash bartender, you know, so there was booze at my disposal, you know, at work. And towards the end, you know, when I mean end, I mean 10 years of drinking left in me, all I thought about was drinking. Like, open my eyes and go, when am I going to drink today? You know, when can I drink today? You know, in retrospect, to be in, like, denial for that period is just amazing. You know, alcoholism was rampant in my family. My brother committed suicide with a shotgun to his head when he was 24 years old because he was a drug addict and an alcoholic. It wasn't like alcoholism was a mystery to me. My father was an alcoholic. My older brother was an alcoholic. Alcohol, you know, at first was, you know, fun. It was a way to, you know, release and hang out with people after work and socialize and party. And Boston in the 80s was a fun place to be, and True for Ones and dance clubs and disco. And, you know, I try to think what, you know, really wasn't that bad, but, you know, it was very early on that I cracked my face off the curb in the early 80s and woke up with a huge gash in my chin and didn't know what happened, you know. So it was never really good, let me put it that way, you know. So I'll just, you know, the end came in 2000 when two of my alcoholic friends, we got into a van and we were heading out to Arizona. Why we're heading out to Arizona? Well, it was why not head out to Arizona? And I had a few thousand dollars and some credit cards, and they drank like I did. And so when they asked me to go, I said, sure, I had nothing holding me back. At this point, I was living in my mom's house in an 8x10 room, and the closet was full of the vodka bottles. So I had to dispose of those vodka bottles before I hit the road. Like, sitting there wrapping them up one by one in newspaper, you know, and putting them in a trash bag so nobody would know that I had literally, I don't know, 100 plus vodka bottles. Mothers know everything about their children, as far as I'm concerned, in retrospect, you know. So, you know, when the van pulled up and I said goodbye to my mother, you know, she looked at me as if she'd never seen me again. You know, and she just kind of looked at me like I don't know what it was, and I kind of didn't care, you know. I got into the van and we went to Arizona. I was only there for a few months, from November to June 7th, actually. And within that period of time, we drove out cross country, got to Oklahoma. I knew things were turning bad at that point. Kelly and Chris were fighting, and I was kind of like in the middle. And I'll tell you, we went cross country. We got out to Apache Junction, which is in Arizona. It's like in a mountain range there. And we went to this campground in the desert, and we found a little camp spot, $10 a night. And on one side were mountains that jutted like 2,000 feet in the air. And on the other side of us were cliffs that went down 2,000 feet in the air. And there were cactuses that went 40 feet in the air. And they were just bizarre. And if you've ever been to the desert, then you know what I mean. If you've never been, then you need to go, because it's like being on another planet. So all this time I'm boozing it up, you know what I mean? And I'd be waking up and, you know, like kind of like lost, and be like, you know, like little quails and coyotes running around, and I'm like, what am I doing here, you know? At that point, we kind of got a little place to live, and I got a really menial job making probably $200 a week, and that was enough to keep me in booze, and that's what I did. I drank as much beer and hot liquor as I could, and I walked to work every day, a mile and a half, and then walked all the way back again. And when it's 98 degrees at 10 a.m. in the morning, it's really not a lot of fun to do. And the thing is, you know, walking in towards the east was this mountain range called the Superstition Mountains. And they went so high up that they were snow peaked, you know, because it was like in December, January at that point. So it's like 98 degrees, I'm sweating and hungover in the morning, and I can't stand it. And I'm looking, walking towards the east, and these mountains are rising into the sky with snow caps on them, you know. And I start going like, what am I doing here? And the beauty around me was so intense. And the way I felt, the misery and the desolation was so bad, I started to like unravel kind of really quickly. So, booze, 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 drink, drink, drink. I had to walk to work one day in a sandstorm, and it's kind of like hail but with sand, and the winds are going like, I don't know, like 80 miles an hour, and like, the roofs are peeling off buildings. It wasn't that bad, but I mean, you can just imagine. It was just, you know, I'm just like, what am I doing here? Like, this is insane. So I get to work, and I'm looking out the window, and the palm trees are like going like this, like ready to rip out of the ground. And I start going like, I'm in the middle of the restaurant with people in it at a bus station. I look up and I start having this conversation with God, who I haven't spoken to in, you know, I don't know, like 10 years. And I want answers. I want to know why he did this to me. Like, why God did this to me, you know. And I'm all indignant about it too, right? I never hurt anybody. You know, what did I ever do to deserve this? And I really started like, I don't know what anybody thought was going on with me standing there, but I was just unraveling at that point and having this conversation, and it was like this hammer came down and hit me. It was like every decision I made in my life, I was responsible for, and that's why I was here in this restaurant in the desert in the middle of a sandstorm. Like, nobody was responsible but myself. And that was really, really like a difficult thing, because I couldn't blame you, and I couldn't blame my mother. I couldn't blame anybody. And that was my spiritual awakening before I even put down the booze. And I stopped blaming God, and went out to the parking lot and had a nervous breakdown. And the owner came out, and, you know, he was like, shh, you know, don't worry, we'll get you back home. So, you know, I ended up getting on a plane to back home to Boston, through circumstances, and when I landed in Logan Airport, there was no welcome home, there was no fanfare, no one was there to greet me except for my sister, you know, and she got me in the car, and that was June 7th, and she drove me out to the beach, and she said, you either go into a detox, or you go into Bridgewater, which was a correction facility that you got paint slipped into, which meant that you were a danger to yourself and to others, so if people could write you in. So, you know, so it was another breakdown, right? So, you know, I hadn't cried in years, you know what I mean? I had nothing to cry about. My life just sucked so much, it didn't even matter. So I just kind of broke down, started crying. And she goes, you have a whole life ahead of you. Like, so I agreed to do it, and I got in the car and drove to my first ever detox. After 20-something years of drinking, right? My first detox. And it was in the ghetto of Boston, and it was full of heroin addicts. So they put me in a dark room, and they say, we'll be right back. And an hour goes by, right? And this is like, you know, I'm being tested whether or not I want it bad enough. And I'm going to show them. I'm not leaving. And another half hour goes by, and then they start to admit me, you know, with the process. And I felt really alone. I had $98 in my pocket. My sister dropped me off. She said, you can't come home again. Like, I was, you know, I thought I was, like, not that bad. They didn't want to see me. They didn't want me home. And that hurt a lot. And it was actually after I got sober that I felt a real sense of betrayal, you know, from the family. But I went into this five-day detox, and they were all heroin addicts. I'm like, where are the alcoholics, you know? And people knew me because of my family in Boston. And so I was lucky enough that in this detox, a couple of people knew me. They were like, oh, you're Mikey's brother. So they watched out for me. And I can't remember the last time I didn't have booze in my system. It was like years, you know. So it was a five-day detox. And when I was to be released, they came to do all the release papers, and I said, well, what do I do now? And they said, well, you leave. And I said, well, I don't have anywhere to go. And they were like, yeah. And I'm like, no, I have nowhere to go. And they were like, yeah. I was like, no, I have nowhere to go. So they didn't believe me because it was a spin dry, and that phrase means a lot of heroin addicts would go in, they'd spin dry, and then go back out and use again. Same thing with the alcoholics. They did it for, like, they could stay there for a couple of days and get a bed in like, 3 square miles or whatever. So I started getting really angry, and I said, you don't understand. Like, I have nowhere to go. I've never been in a detox before, and I need help. So right off the bat, I'm asking for help, you know. And they were like, really? And I'm like, yeah, really. Like, really? And I'm like, yeah, really. Like, I need help. So they were like, oh, well, we're going to take you seriously now. So they signed me up to a 14-day program, intensive inpatient treatment. And at this point, I was eating Snickers bars and didn't care. I was, like, hallucinating and eating Snickers bars and just was, like, just kind of doing what I was told at that point. And they brought me to a 14-day program north of Boston, and I'm like shaking, rattling, and rolling. It's like a dormitory, women on the bottom, men on the top. And I walk into a conference room that has the 12 and 12 on the wall, and I see God immediately, and I'm like, you know what? I'm freaking out of here. And the guy next to me heard me, and he said, it can be any God you want it to be. And I said, what? He goes, you can be any God you want it to be. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, that works for me. They, you know, retelling this, you know, I mean, I was, like, surrendered, like, from the get-go. I mean, So, you know, what it was alcoholic education for 14 days. They fed you, they put a roof over your head, they let you smoke, you did chores, you scrubbed toilets, you washed floors. And I was all good with that, you know. And I'm like, what do I do next? And they said, well, you have options. You can either go on your own. And I'm like, no, it's not an option. Or we can send you to a halfway house. So I took the halfway house option, which I thought was, I wasn't sure what it was, but it was a six-month program, and at first I was like, wow, it's a long time. And the counselor said, well, you drank for 20 years, so what do you think? And I'm going, well, yeah, you're right. So, you know, they gave me a diploma. I graduated, and then I went to a holding because there was no rooms, and then things kind of moved along, and I ended up into this this halfway house south of Boston, which I knew that town. And I was warned ahead of time it was a boot camp, and they didn't take any, like, no second chances. If you were told not to smoke after 10 o'clock and you were caught smoking, you were thrown out. There was no second chances whatsoever. If you didn't do your chores and you were told to, you were thrown out. So I did what I was supposed to do. I followed orders, and we had 7 AA meetings a week, 4 house meetings a week, and if you weren't working weekends, Saturday or Sunday, then 2 AA meetings, Saturday or Sunday. So I was told to get a sponsor. I did. I was told to join a group. I did. I was told to hand out raffle tickets. I did. I was told to collect money. I did. I did what I was told, and I just really didn't question it. You know, they said, you know, after 90 days, you get to speak at commitments. Most people shied away from it. I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait to tell the world how you all wronged me. Even though, like, you know, I kind of knew it wasn't true. But so my 90 days came, and I would get up to the podium, and people would just, like, crack up and laugh and have a great time listening to me because I was just so insane, you know. I had a job at that point, and they were somebody was bullying me. And because they knew the address, they knew that 10 Dysart Street was a halfway house. So when I fill out the job in the application, they're like, oh, here's another freaking drunk from the halfway house, right? And the guy did everything to push my buttons, you know. And here I am, like, shaking, 4 months sober, going, like, you know, like, how do I handle the situation? And so I'm up at the podium telling people how, like, you know, being bullied and all that. One day the guy hit me off the back of the head with a sheet pan. At work, and I was like, you know, a couple days later, he went by me when I was at the sandwich board, and he didn't bump into me, he barreled past me and pushed me, and I was holding a kitchen knife in my hand, and I turned around and I put it to his stomach, and I said, you know what, you got to be really careful in the kitchen, because people who have knives in their hands. So, you know, I have a knife at the guy's stomach. And I put the knife down, and he walked away. And I said, I've never been in jail a day in my life. Now I'm sober, and I'm going to kill somebody. I'm going to go to jail for good, you know. So, you know, I talked to my counselor about it. And he says, you got to quit the job. And I'm like, all right, I will. So, you know, I mean, from the get-go, sobriety was really just, it wasn't a picnic, that's for sure. Pink Cloud didn't know what it was, you know. All I know was in October of 2001, I laughed. I remember laughing in October of 2001 outside a meeting. And, you know, I mean, that shows you how the 20 years were. Like, I didn't laugh. I didn't smile. I didn't, you know what I mean? I remember just laughing at something. I don't know what it was, but. So I finished the halfway house. You know, they gave me a diploma, and I ended up in a boarding house. I paid by the week, and my family kind of still wanted nothing to do with me, and I really wanted nothing to do with them either, you know. And I basically started my life all over again. And I went to meetings in Boston, and I did service kind of from the get-go. And somebody from my drinking days was in the halls, and he grabbed me, and he started giving me rides home, and he nominated me for coffee maker for 6 months, and that nearly killed me. And then I was a greeter for 6 months, and then I was like something else for 6 months, and that's how I know like 2.5 years kind of went along, you know. But really, like, if you told me to do anything, I kind of, you know, I'd bitch about it, but I'd step up and do it because it's probably some deep-seated fear, you know. I'm not sure what it was, but so heading to 2 years, all of a sudden I got really sick, which was not good. I have Graves' disease, which is an autoimmune disease, which I went undiagnosed for like probably 7 months in my second year. Started losing chunks of my hair. My immune system started to explode. I had tremors, and I started losing weight rapidly. And they did HIV testing, and it came back negative. And then they did it again, and it came back negative. And I had a textbook case of Graves' disease, but because I was the wrong gender, they couldn't identify it, right? They're like, oh, yeah, you know, this is what this is. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, it happens, you know, mostly to, you know, females. Oh, geez, oh, you know, awfully sorry about that. You know, and I'm like, you know, I'm like 100 pounds, like a coat hanger, you know. Everybody thinks I'm dying of AIDS. They won't come near me, you know. I did have 4 good friends at that point in the program who always called me and stuck by me, but I was so sick, I really couldn't go to meetings. I actually was going to work, but I wasn't going to meetings so much. And my life, you know, my second year was just totally... My health was really, really bad, and it was just kind of not a happy time. And I got into, you know, right before the end was near, you know, like my second year, when I was down to like about 115, 20 pounds, and my hands were shaking, and I couldn't control myself, like my motor functions and all that, and I got a huge infection on my face that was the size of a freaking orange. And I walked into a clinic, and they pulled me in right away. They took my heart rate, it was 125. They put pure oxygen on my face, right? And I'm laying there going, nobody knows where I am. Nobody. And I'm going to die alone. But I'm sober. Great. So, but that's when they diagnosed that they knew exactly what was wrong with me. And you know, you think, oh, well, you know, that's great now. Like, things are, like, you know, on the upswing. But I went through probably up to another 3 years of being on a drug to stabilize the imbalance I had with my thyroid gland. And I was just angry, bitter, angry, bitter, angry. You know, I didn't make a lot of friends because I was angry and bitter, you know. Nobody would come near me, you know, literally. Like, if I came on the side of me, people, like, would... sit on the other side. There was always empty seats around me, you know. And, you know, it just wasn't a good time. And, you know, this is going into the third year and into the fourth year. I became a workaholic. I got, you know, I got a promotion. I got a raise. In the meantime, like, my teeth are falling out. And I think they have to deal with my, just everything. Everything, life on life's terms, you know. The only difference was I was doing the next right thing and I was showing up and doing what I was supposed to do. And that was going to the doctor, going to the dentist, going to the doctor, going to the dentist, going to meetings, going to the doctor, going to the dentist. You know, so, you know, it was only up until like the last 2 years I had a radiation treatment to dissolve the thyroid gland. And I was like, well, then what happens? And they says, well, you know, then we just go on a hormone pill once a day. And I was like, well, that's good. You know, and a couple weeks later, you know, they did a follow-up and the radiation didn't work. So, you know, I'm like, why not? And they said, well, the dose wasn't strong enough. So I just, like, flipped out on the doctor and, you know... I apologized afterwards, but I said, you know, for Christ's sake, look at me, you know, I'm a wreck, I can't even live up my life, you know. Do something about it. This is what you're supposed to do, you know, you're a top endocrinologist, you know. You know, at this point I realized that some things, you know, I had to just, like, go with the flow, and I realized... a little bit of compassion for other people and started to, you know, pull back on the anger and the resentments and all that. And I finally got the radiation done right and everything's been just really great ever since. I'm going on 8 years, you know, and, you know, on June 7th, I haven't had the desire to pick up a drink, and that I don't know why. I don't know why I've never had the desire to pick up a drink. Before, I used to scoff at relapsers. Like, you can't get it. I mean, really, you can't get it, right? I didn't understand why people relapsed. I kept coming, and I finally realized, you know, it is what it is. I realized that I was out there living in a gin bottle for 20 years, and people that come into the halls and then relapse and go out, and then they come back in again, and then they go out again, and they come in, they have something that I didn't have. They had phone numbers. You know? So, I was envious. I was like, and I'll say that to people when they slip. I was like, you know, you have something that I didn't have for 20 years. You have phone numbers. You know, as far as, you know, the program, you know, giving back what was given to me freely, you just heard what I said about my first 5 years. I didn't have anything that anybody wanted. I was just angry and nasty and not pleasant to be around. Didn't sponsor people. When things kind of simmered down a little bit, I started to, you know, raising my hand for sponsorship and did get sponsees, and I don't have any active sponsees right now. They come, they go, you know, I don't know what to do about it. I don't know how to handle it very well, you know. I'm very independent as a person, so I don't think I really make a good sponsor, because I don't know, I'm not cut out for it, for the sponsorship. What I do is service, and I figure that's my part in the program. I'll still raise my hand to sponsor people, but because it's not an active part of my sober life, I do service for groups as much as I can. I try to get people into the business meetings when we have the elections, get, you know, the newcomers to sit in chairs and stay afterwards, you know, to get them involved. You know, there's other ways I can help in the program. Recently attended a few roundups, a couple in Florida and a couple in Cape Cod, and trying to be more active in AA as an institution. I become the central service delegate for one group in Boston, and that basically just means I go to central service one Wednesday a month. We sit and we go through minutes of meetings that other parts, other fractions of the other committees do. And I have that position because someone nominated me, and I had no reason to say no. But if that gets me to do service, then I'll go with it, you know. The Fellowship of AA is basically responsible for where I am today, what I have today. I was told to show up and sit in chairs, and that's what I did. I had no question not to. And they used to tell us to take the cotton out of our ears and stick it in our mouths. And that's what I did for the first, you know, few months. Without AA, basically, I don't know where I'd be today. I didn't want to think about it, but the thing is, I can't realize my life with a drink. In my life today, before I didn't know what my life would be without drinking. Now I can't realize what my life would be like if I did drink. So I think I really just, you know, the first drink for me, I don't want to know where it'll take me. And the only thing I know for sure is it's not going to be any place good. It's not going to be any place where I want to be. So, you know, I'm thinking, you know, the other day I was, you know, complaining about my life. I was complaining about my job. I'm unhappy with my job, and I'm unhappy with a few other parts of my personal life. And then I pick up the phone and talk to my sister, and she's laid on her mortgage. She hasn't made any money since August. And, you know, she's in a deep hole. So I realized that I had luxury problems at that point, you know. So what I do now, I can't do anything for her. I can't pay her mortgage, and I can't make her any money. But what I do is I call her once a week now instead of like once every 2 weeks to check in with her. Try to make myself available for other people. I show up for other people even if I don't want to. You know, there's a christening, there's a baby shower, you know. I show up because I'm invited to, so. I'm glad I'm here, and I really don't know much else to say except for, you know, 20 years out there and 8 years in here, and I feel very, very lucky that I found the halls. And the people sitting in the chairs are the ones that were responsible for my sobriety. And when my sponsor told me that in my first year that I wasn't responsible for my own sobriety, I didn't understand, I didn't know how to take it. But now I realize that people in the halls, you people sitting here, you're responsible for my sobriety. Because if you weren't here, I wouldn't be here and I wouldn't be sober, you know. There's one meeting that's I'm a member of, and it's a Wednesday open discussion meeting. And occasionally you get like university and college students that come in and they sit in for the meeting as part of their course. And it's like, they must think it's we're like a bunch of like insane people. Because it took me so long to understand AA, like years to the dynamics of the fellowship. And these people come and they sit in for like a half hour, 40 minutes, and they leave. And I don't know, I love to read what they write down to and give to their teacher, you know. But it's an open meeting, so, you know, anybody's, you know, more than happy to sit down. But, you know, I've actually sat in meetings. I'll change up my, every now and then I'll hit a meeting on the outskirts of my neighborhood or whatever, and went to one meeting, it was an open meeting, and it was a commitment, and the girl said, that was speaking, says, I wasn't entirely ready to give myself to God. I said, God, you know, if somebody just walked in, they would think it was a cult. You know what I mean? Because the terminology and the words of the program, you know. And I laughed. I chuckled, you know. But we all get it. We all understand. And, you know, that's why it's a safe place to be. So with that, I'll just close. Thank you.